Osman left Naomi with him and went back to the bridge. Bibi split his attention, monitoring the stilted conversation between the Senskas and Osman's next move.
Bibi, can you get me Perengoski, please?
Osman sat back in the command chair on the deserted bridge. Mal, Vaz, Devereaux, Spencer, and Phillips showed up on the system as being on the glass deck, probably playing cards and dissecting the crisis.
And tell me what you're going to do for Naomi.
I'm going to help her access childhood memories, he said, and augment that with Reach archive data.
Is that safe?
It won't kill her, if that's what you're asking.
What if it screws her up?
She asked me to do it. Free will.
Choice.
Self-harm. Driving drunk. Grown woman.
Okay, Bibi, you win.
Can I make a suggestion, though? The only expert left on Spartan 2s is our favourite sociopath, currently sewing mailbags in Ivanov. Love Halsey or hate her, I think we should have her on standby in case we need medical advice. Or even medical intervention. I was hoping we wouldn't have to ship her in. It takes weeks to exercise the place afterward. Bibi joked about Halsey's awfulness while still meaning every syllable. But perhaps he was sanitizing her too much with humor. It was more for his sanity than anyone else's, though. I don't mind the plague of flies so much. It's stopping the blood oozing from the faucets.
I was thinking of going to her, actually, Osman said. Fascinating as it would be to stick her in a cage fight with Staffan and Vaz. Hell, I'd go get my baseball bat too.
So how much are we telling Staffan, Mom? He probably knows more now than Spencer does.
Whatever's history, I'd like to think that the world would be outraged if it knew what went on, but you and I know the average citizen couldn't give a shit. He can talk, but he won't be heard.
At least his family could be told he wasn't delusional. Osman nodded.
Maybe.
Bibi could see Staffan in the wardroom, showing Naomi some very old photos. Bibi had seen the official Oni images of Naomi that were taken at intervals to chart her progress from the day she was abducted to the day she deployed for the first time. Grim mugshots. But this was family stuff, touching and tragic. Bibi would have to make use of those. Then Perengoski responded, and Osman picked her way through a minefield.
Ma'am, I'm trying to negotiate the handover of Inquisitor, Osman said. It's taking some unorthodox methods.
Do I need to know how unorthodox?
No ramifications beyond individuals, but I need to ask permission for something delicate.
Go ahead, Saren. If you feel you have to.
Halsey, I might need access to her to help Naomi out with an implant issue.
Well, she's still at Ivanov as of today. You've got full access there. It was a day's transit to the Oni research facility for Stanley's souped-up drive, so Bibi felt a little more confident about guessing his way around Naomi's memory. But the most interesting thing was that Osman hadn't told Perengoski everything. Not that Perengoski wanted to know. If things went wrong, she'd be the first to find out. If they didn't, it would be a story over dinner the next time Osman was in Sydney, or maybe never shared at all. Osman ended the call.
Okay, Bibi. All yours.
Do you mind my asking if you meant what you said to Staffan, Mom? She looked off to one side for a second.
I think I did. The question is whether he did.
And if Naomi wants to leave the surface?
Then I have to ask myself if I believe what I say I do, or if I'm like all the others and I opt to solve it the only way. But a retired Spartan isn't any more of a security risk than anyone else leaving Special Forces. Actually, much less.
She stood up and stretched, joints cracking alarmingly.
Naomi can't go on forever. But a battlecruiser will be a threat for another 50 to 100 years with refits, maybe more.
Osman had squared the morality with operational needs. It was what she was supposed to do, but Bibi was still waiting for the time when the two didn't mesh perfectly, and she had to make a harder choice.
I'll go scrub up then, he said. Have you seen Naomi's sister? Actually, no.
Weird, Dad. Staffan's close to his son, according to Mal.
Not the daughter, Hedda.
You think it'd be the other way around, given what happened to Naomi?
Bibi could understand exactly why Staffan didn't cling to Hedda. No, he's lost two daughters, Naomi and the clone, so he's just as likely to find it harder to relate to Hedda than to Edvin. Or maybe he feels he's protecting her by excluding her from his world. He's in a dangerous business.
Osman seemed to think it over, nodding.
You're right. You should have been a shrink.
I'd have been very, very expensive. Bibi clothed it in a joke. If he wasn't as good as Osman thought he was, then Naomi would find out the hard way. Her therapy had suddenly become the most important task he'd ever perform, and he wasn't sure why. Naomi had retreated to her cabin for the process. Bibi rapped on the door by making knock-knock noises, then materialized inside when she said to come in. It was a very tidy cabin, not an unusual thing in itself for naval personnel, but devoid of personal touches like pictures from home. Or at least it had been. Now, Naomi held a photo of herself and her parents that looked as if it had been taken at a fun fair on a windy day. This is going to hurt, isn't it? She said. She put the docking chip in the console repeater so Bibi could transfer to it. She didn't need her armor this time. Bibi wasn't touching her motor regions, just her memory.
But ignorance isn't bliss. It's just a lack of intel that you need to make a reasoned assessment.
Personally, I treasure it, Bibi said. I can firewall information that I don't want to access, but I know I've done it. So I know that I know something, but I don't know what I know, or why it was a good idea to avoid knowing or recalling it. That's an uncomfortable sensation, not bliss. Bibi had always been aware that his disdain for getting too invested in humans' lives was a defense. If you liked them, loved them, even, then it was doomed, because you'd be gone in a few short years, leaving them to miss you. They knew you were short-lived, too, so the more emotionally aware ones could predict the pain to come, and either dwell on the unfairness of scheduled bereavement, or keep their distance to minimize it. The dolts, who thought AIs were just clever but unfeeling programs, lived in happy denial both of the reality of AIs and of emotions in general. For all their pretense at scientific attitudes, they were still anchored in the voodoo of religion, the belief that humans were unique, wonderful, and qualitatively different. The work of a god that made them unlike any other species that ever lived or ever would. Not even the painful evidence of aliens trashing their worlds had dented that belief. Bibi knew he had been both human and not human. He was the Oracle Tiresias, experiencing both sides of life and existence. An odd parallel not lost on him when he considered that Tiresias was reluctant to reveal all the details of his visions, either as a man or as a woman. Maybe when you fully understood all sides, you knew there were some things people couldn't handle knowing. There were things he knew that he couldn't handle himself, otherwise he would never have firewalled them so thoroughly. Programming. How do you think your brains work, meatbags? How do you think you made me? You're programmed too, and because you are, I can exist. He wanted to tell them, but it wouldn't work. Humans were too dominated by emotion to see it for what it was, that every living thing, organic or otherwise, needed hardwired reactions to survive, to avoid what would damage it, to pursue what would help it reproduce, to cling to others of its own kind because it maximized survival, and to have those life-preserving behaviors reinforced by chemical reactions that guaranteed they would be performed and not ignored. Humans called those reactions fear, ambition, or love. The basic skills that were necessary to life, communication, using experience to avoid future threats, weren't solely human traits of language or abstract thinking, but variations on the tools that all life used. Bibi could now see no difference between the amoeba moving away from something hot and the man fleeing a tiger or an angry boss. Humans believed they thought things consciously, when most of the time they were simply rationalizing instinctive reactions as basic as the amoeba's, and after those reactions had already taken place. But there was no telling them that. Not even the ones who knew better, like Halsey. They needed their sense of unique superiority, and the elaborate ritual that supported it every bit as much as the Covenant needed theirs. Bibi blamed the universe for that. It was so vast and so indifferent to the little life-forms who thought they were the sole reason for its existence that it must have made them feel small, lonely, and unspecial, in need of some secret that reassured them they were a lot more important than that. He saw it all now. He didn't see it when he was... when I was what? What made me think all that? He knew only that when he was another self, his donor, the not him, but the source of his existence, that he simply didn't understand what he did now, or didn't want to. I had to buffer myself. I had to lie. Whoa, Bibi said. How long had he been mulling that over? Damn, was he having a pre-rampancy moment? Where did that come from? Naomi looked at him. Are you okay? You sort of froze for a second. Actually, no, he said. I'm not okay. I'm having a bit of memory leakage. Better put cerebral incontinence pads on the grocery list, dear. Now, shall we proceed? This task required his matrix, not a pared-down fragment. He transferred himself to the chip, laden with the records he'd harvested from Oni. For a moment, he was disoriented by lack of input. Then he found himself looking at the cabin bulkhead, gray composite, the even spread of a concealed light above the pull-down desktop, and a glimpse of a dark blue bed cover tucked under the edges of a bunk mattress with the precision of an envelope. It was a stark and impressionistic still life seen through the trichromatic filter of the human retina, but he could also see a network of lights and lines superimposed on it, a mesh of enormous and beautiful complexity that he could both reach and touch, like an ancient switchboard operator connecting calls, or travel along like a flume at a beach resort. It was the map of a human brain. Naomi's brain. A unique alien world in itself. Bibi focused on a photo that moved into his field of view. It was a day at the fun fair that came flooding back with the scent of salt air and frying donuts. He was almost convinced that he recalled how delicious those things smelled. UNSC Port Stanley. Quarters of Petty Officer Naomi 010. I am a Spartan. There is no situation I cannot handle, resolve, or face with equanimity. Where did I hear that? What are you doing, Bibi?
Keep looking at the picture.
What's it like outside?
I've located it, Naomi. Look at your mother.
She couldn't actually hear Bibi in the physical sense. He could have generated sound via the cabin's audio, but this was unrecorded, private stuff. Now it felt less like thinking someone else's thoughts and more like the lyrics of a song, words that formed in her head like a reflex that she couldn't change.
Go on. Concentrate on your mother.
I don't remember her. Yes. Yes, I do.
What did you want for your birthday?
A doll's house. Oh, I remember that now. The toy store in town. It filled the window.
Now look at the file.
That's Reach. I think it's home. No, it's not. The stars look different. I can't see the same sky. But how can I see the sky when it's underground? And I hate that taste. The medicine smells of raspberries. Not real ones. Artificial flavoring, but what's underneath still tastes bitter. Bibi, I'm tasting things. Actually tasting them.
Okay. I know why that's happening. Don't worry. Just relax and keep talking.
Naomi had been conscious for brain surgery when her neural implant was inserted, listening to an unseen surgeon asking her questions and adjusting something while her body did things she had no control over. From slurring her speech to making her heart race. There was no pain. She just didn't like being operated like a machine. Helplessness. Yes, that was it. It made her want to lash out. Your heart rate's up, BB said. Shall I stop for a moment?
No, just do it.
I'm trying to avoid influencing you by asking questions. You know how susceptible human memory is. You've said that a dozen times. Is that your get-out clause?
What, for practicing medicine without a license?
Have I ever asked you to take your clothes off for an eye test? As I told the judge, that was all a terrible misunderstanding.
Poor old BB. The more he went into his stand-up routine, the more uneasy he was.
If what I recall is bad, you'll be able to tell me it never happened anyway, Naomi said. Just a false memory caused by integrating suggestions and assorted garbage.
First, do no harm.
BB seemed to be reminding himself. It didn't sound like a joke.
I don't want to make matters worse.
Naomi sat back on her bunk, spine pressed against the padded bulkhead. This wasn't like hypnosis or meditation. She was fully conscious, letting her mind wander as best she could. The longer she looked at the photo of the day at the fair, the less certain she was about what she recalled.
Donuts, she said.
There was a fun fair on the coast. Sometimes she'd catch a whiff of that cinnamon and frying oil smell even now, and she could not only taste donuts again, but feel them, too. Now she remembered the context. They were served up boiling hot in a greaseproof bag. She could feel them burning her palm and then her fingers as she fished one ring of heavy, luscious, sugar-gritted pastry from the bag and bit into it. Her teeth crunched through the heavy dredging of sugar and then sank into soft, compressible, rather bland dough that wasn't all that sweet. An elusive flavor she chased but never caught, made more tantalizing by the residue of sugar it left on her lips and chin. Her mother leaned over her and wiped her mouth with something cool and wet, tutting. Naomi tried to recall her mother's face, but it was hard to differentiate between what she recalled and what was being filled in by the photo.
I felt sticky. Sticky from the sugar. Sticky from the salt on the wind. My hair was all tangles.
Her father looked happy in the photo, though. Who had taken it, if they were all in it? A neighbor? A friend? A stranger? Naomi reached for her data pad and started looking through the documents that BB had assembled, her personal folder, and the assortment of Oni material. She hadn't even read everything that was in her file yet. This was going to take some time, and she was acutely aware that Inquisitor had already been found, probably breached, and might well be beyond Oni's reach by now. Her father seemed to think the Hurrigok could immobilize the vessel and even repel boarders. Either he knew a lot more about the creatures than she did, or a lot less. She tried to imagine Adge or Leeks defending Stanley. They wouldn't. They'd accepted UNSC direction without murmur, just as they'd accepted the orders of the Covenant. And he renamed the ship Naomi. I don't know how I feel about that. What are they going to do with him? Hand him over to an Oni debriefing in Sydney? Shoot him? Just throw him back into the water like an undersized fish when they're done? Whether she wanted it to or not, it was shaping her reactions already. There were rules and regulations in the Navy. Then there was how you felt about them. She wondered if people thought Spartans were so brainwashed that they could simply decide not to think or feel like everyone else. That she could treat her father like any other insurgent sympathizer and not experience any fallout from it. But she'd told the rest of the team precisely that. She'd said it meant nothing to her, like arresting Catherine Halsey, but she'd been lying to herself. It might not have reduced her to a weeping wreck, but it definitely left a few scuffs.
Damn. But Vasya gets angry and emotional about things, and he's still a good Marine. It doesn't make you any less of what you are.
She braced herself and opened the documents closest to the date that she'd been abducted. September 10, 2517. She'd almost forgotten BB was there behind her eyes and reading it too.
"Is this the wash-up?" she asked. "The retrieval report?"
"Yes," he said. "Allow for the fact that any report's going to be subjective. The mistakes tend to get downplayed and euphemized. The highlights get exaggerated. I have read UNSC bullshit before, BB. I may even have written some."
"About yourself?"
He had a point. He always did. Headings like Subject, Senska, Naomi, Subject 010, Date of Birth September 15, 2511, never got things off to a good start. It had been filed by Retrieval Team Theta 2. RT Theta 2. She read it like a Spartan at first, just looking for the salient points, and noted how little space and how few words the destruction of her real life was worth. It wasn't even a page. She was referred to throughout simply as Subject 010. Subject 010 had been observed over a period of 7 months in Alstead, New Atlantic Province, Sansar. Data was gathered from routine school medical checks, and also via the bogus CAA Gifted and Special Needs Children pilot study, created to gain extra access to identified candidates. We have no reason to believe that insufficient data was collected, and that this led to the problems retrieving the subject. One of the staff at the subject's school did query the authority of Theta 2 personnel, posing as educational psychologists, but seemed satisfied by the paperwork and the promise of special funding from the CAA if any children in the school were identified as gifted and requiring special measures. During psych evaluation by Dr. J, Subject 010 also underwent routine health checks such as vision, height, and weight, and the last of those was conducted within a reasonable period of the retrieval. The calculation of the sedative dose required to subdue the subject was correct based on that data, and the dose should have been sufficient even if the subject had gained up to 5 kilos in the intervening period. The risks of accidental overdose in children cannot be overstated. Administering these drugs in a non-clinical environment means that it is prudent to give the lowest recommended dose per kilo. The subject could easily have died before RT Theta 2 was able to reach ONI medical support. Naomi looked up for a moment. This was mostly ass covering. Someone was explaining why her kidnap went wrong, and how it wasn't their fault, no siree, because they'd followed procedure, and the dose should have been enough. It obviously hadn't been then.
So I was sedated. I must have been. I would never have gone off with strangers. Christ, did they accidentally kill any of us before it even started?
She read on. Subject 010 was lured into close physical contact so the sedative could be administered with minimum distress to her. She appeared to be fully sedated when placed in the support vehicle, but she regained consciousness while her clothing was being transferred to the clone replacement and became agitated and unexpectedly combative. As a result, she escaped from the vehicle, and a search was carried out to recover her. She was found and recovered 2 hours later, when her behavior became sufficiently disruptive to risk compromising the mission. A decision was taken to give her further sedation. She was removed without further incident, and no lasting physical damage was observed.
"Wow," she murmured.
"You didn't go down and you fought like hell," BB said. "At least I think that's what it means. I did cross-reference the personnel in Theta 2 to see if they'd needed any medical treatment after the kidnap. Couldn't find anything, but I do hope you did a mal on them."
"Did a mal?"
"Mal bites when cornered. Ask him about his interrogation. Ask your father, actually."
"So, remember it?"
"Underwear," she said suddenly. "There." It popped up out of nowhere, out of context.
"Oh, God. I woke up and someone was undressing me."
She was lying flat on something in a strange place that wasn't her bedroom. She knew where she really was, sitting cross-legged on her bunk in Port Stanley, but she was also 5, going on 6, with a weird taste in her mouth, head spinning, and someone was pulling her dress off her shoulders. There was a small pinpoint of light shining in her eyes from one side. The noises and movement told her she was in a car, and a woman was undressing her. She started struggling.
Damn, she's coming around, the woman said. How much did you give her?
Naomi started kicking and screaming for Mom. She wasn't sure exactly what people like that did to you, but she knew it was bad and wrong. So bad that the teachers warned the class about it regularly.
It's okay, honey, it's okay. Take it easy. Nobody's gonna hurt you. Liar, 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 liar!
Naomi screamed as loud and as long as she could. That was what grown-ups had told her to do if a stranger grabbed her. To scream and make a fuss until someone noticed and came to help her. She was in a car. Who would hear her? Nobody. She had to get out. She had to get out now. The grown-ups in the car were arguing about something, and a man was saying they couldn't give her any more. The car swerved. Naomi could see the handle on the inside of the door. She'd never been so scared in her life, because Mom and Dad didn't know where she was, and it was all her fault because she hadn't gone straight home. The car slowed down. As soon as the woman leaned back, Naomi flew at her, clawing and screaming, and then she reached for the door latch. The door was suddenly gone. She was falling through a black void, hitting the ground so hard that it shook her teeth, rolling, dizzy, but she was up and running before she even knew where she was. She ran into the darkness. She tripped over a curb, stumbled through grass, and saw trees streak past her. She heard nothing but her own gasping breaths. As she ran for her life. Her feet hurt. Her shoes were gone. She was wearing a long tunic of some kind, and it flapped around her knees. They were behind her. She could hear their urgent whispers. Where was she? She couldn't see any lights now, just the dark on darkness of trees against the speckled night sky. Her feet hurt, and she wanted her mom.
Where's my watch?
She'd lost her watch. The grown-up watch that Dad had given her. No, the woman had taken it, along with her clothes. If they were chasing her, Naomi had to keep quiet now. Running was noisy. She crept through spiky grass that was getting taller and taller around her, and then her feet slid into cold water and slippery mud.
Don't scream, not this time.
She held her breath and squatted in the water, hugging her knees in the cover of the tall grass. This was a big river. The stream near her house was small and bubbled over rocks, but this was slow and still, and her feet were in mud. So she was a long way from home. She felt like she'd held her breath forever, trying not to cry because they'd hear her. She'd never been this cold in her life. Her legs were getting numb. Eventually, she had to move. She felt her way along the edge of the bank, looking for lights from houses, but there weren't any. What had Dad told her? Rivers flow to the sea. If she put her hand in the water and felt which way it was going, she could walk along the bank and end up somewhere where there were people who'd help her. She'd been sure she was going to get home, right up to the moment she heard a man's voice saying,
"Check the thermal. See it?"
Then someone grabbed her arms and hauled her, kicking and screaming, out of the water. The last thing she saw was that woman leaning over her, hair hanging down. She grabbed it and pulled as hard as she could, punching with her free hand until her arms went tingly and cold. And then she didn't remember anything else.
"Are you okay?"
Bibi asked. "Your heart rate's way up."
"I remembered,"
Naomi said. She couldn't go through all that detail again. It made her feel worse than she'd expected.
"Waking up in the car and escaping. But they still found me."
How could she have gotten herself into that mess? She was just coming home from school. She didn't recall the detail. It was dark, though. She would have been home in daylight if it was mid-September, so she must have stayed late for some class or other. She wanted to look at the night sky, so she got off the bus a stop early again to take a look from the field. There was so few street lights around there that she could see everything like an astronomy textbook. Stars beyond stars, and the hazy ribbons of the galactic plane. Dad had told her to always come straight home. It was a grown-up privilege to be allowed to travel to and from school on her own, so she had to be responsible about it. A couple of people got off the bus at the same stop, but she was too intent on the night sky to look at them. And anyway, Mum had said not to talk to people she didn't know, or look at them in case... In case what? She thought she knew now, but she didn't know then. Look behind you and you look like a victim. Anyone who's thinking of sneaking up on you is more likely to think you're scared and take a chance. But that was her adult rationalization. She couldn't have thought in those terms back then. She saw a light traveling along the top of a hedge, bright orange, so it couldn't have been a firebug, because they were green, and it wasn't the right time of year. How far away was it? Maybe it was a shuttle taking off in the distance. She couldn't tell. But it was going in a very straight, horizontal line, which shuttles didn't do, and it was just one light, not a cluster of different colors. Dad had told her never to wander off at night, and to stay on the lit road where she could be seen. But she couldn't explain that light, and she needed to. She had to find things out. She climbed over the wooden turnstile and headed into the field, picking her way over rutted furrows. The light might have been getting closer, or moving away, she still couldn't tell. Then she fell. She remembered putting out her hand to stop the fall and thinking that Mum would be mad if she came home with mud on her dress. It was only a shallow ditch, but at the time she thought she'd never stop falling. That was when she heard the thwop, thwop, thwop of someone running as fast as they could through soft soil, and someone grabbed her around the waist. She screamed.
"For Christ's sake, shut her up before the whole town hears her,"
a man's voice said. So now she knew. If she'd remembered what had happened, and not what she'd pieced together from what she knew of Oni, then she'd made the mistake of getting off the bus in a dark place and being too curious for her own good. But she hadn't gone off with a stranger voluntarily. That was something. She hadn't been irresponsible.
"I remembered," she said. "A lot of it, anyway. Maybe too much. It feels real, though. Want to tell me?"
Bibi asked.
"Later. They must have followed me for weeks to know I was getting off the bus early. They knew all about me, didn't they?"
"Governments try to," Bibi said. "And always for their own good, never yours." Bibi waited while she scrolled through some recordings from her first 3 days in Castle, buried deep under the surface of Reach, where no amount of screaming for Mom and Dad would ever be heard. The assessment team had recorded video footage of the kids working out where they were, and even clinging to each other for comfort. 75 scared, baffled, and even angry children who didn't quite get this idea of being chosen to save the world. Naomi couldn't believe that she'd been like that. One clip showed her taking a swing at a guy in a lab coat, pummeling him with her fists and telling him that her dad was going to kill him if he didn't take her home. So much for Halsey's journal entries that suggested tearful but generally compliant children. The woman barely mentioned how much they fought back, and when she did, it was almost with amusement. But as Naomi worked through the clips, videos of her regular talks with Halsey and the other doctors, she watched herself get more withdrawn and cowed down day by day, asking to go home and begging for her mom and dad. In one session, she heard herself say that her daddy really loved her, so he'd come and save her.
"Daddy's not coming for you, Naomi,"
Halsey was saying. It was a young Halsey, dark-haired, 30 or so.
"He knows you've got an important job to do. He knows you're too special to be anything other than a Spartan." "Lying bitch. You made me doubt my own father. You made me think he'd abandoned me. But you weren't the only one, were you?"
Naomi's anger was here and now. It wasn't sorrow for her lost childhood. It was anger at the adults who'd betrayed them all by not doing the most basic thing a human adult was supposed to protect a child. Her father had tried his damnedest to do that, and she'd never known until the last few weeks, more than 30 years too late. That was the worst bit. It hurt with a fresh pain that she hadn't been expecting. She didn't remember that at all until now. She realized her parents were never coming for her, and that she was utterly alone. Her father wasn't going to save her. She had a sudden, vivid pang of hurt, angry, desperate fear, and remembered how she thought her dad had let Halsey take her. And that's why I go all out to retrieve my buddies, to rescue Mal. Nobody should feel that they've been abandoned. I understand now. I thought Dad had let me down, Bibi, she said. Knowing what I know now, knowing how he spent a lifetime looking for me, knowing what Mom went through, I really wish I hadn't remembered that. She put the data pad down and raked her fingers through her hair. Well, she asked to know, and now she knew. Maybe the memories of the abduction were distorted by the lack of understanding of a small child, or embellished by her later knowledge and Halsey's journal, but there was no arguing with the videos. When she absorbed the whole picture, she didn't feel chosen to save humanity. She felt abused. I'm still proud to be a Spartan. If I'd had the chance to volunteer when the Covenant invaded, I'd have done it. I'd do it again in a heartbeat. But this wasn't about the Covenant, was it? It was setting humans against humans. She laughed. That was rich. What's funny? Bibi asked. The Covenant, she said. They're what makes me feel I didn't have my life entirely wasted for me. Are you done? You want a break? Try again later. Naomi looked at her watch. It wasn't her grown-up one, the one Dad had given her. It was a military timepiece, all dials and meters. She really would have liked to have had her old watch back. No, we need to crack on with finding that ship. You can't have made up your mind in that time, Bibi said. I'm not sure I have, she said. But I know what to say to Dad. Naomi tidied her hair and tried to look calm and professional again. Her cheeks were flushed bright pink, which wasn't like her at all. Vaz would comment and ask if she was okay. He was a really good guy, the kind she wished she'd met in a normal life. But that was another world in a parallel universe. Can't blame it all on Halsey, she said. No, but most of it's down to her, so do I still get to stick pins in her? Please. I was thinking of asking Parangoski to have her brain removed and kept in a jar connected to the mainframe, so she could think useful things, but not cause any more damage. And, of course, I could pop in from time to time and torment her, and she could never switch me off. That's not like you, Bibi. Oh, I think it is. How could anyone do that, though? Naomi asked. Halsey couldn't do it alone. She had an army of people willing to do the work for her. What kind of person goes along with a plan to kidnap children and surgically alter them? What kind of doctor would agree to do all that to kids? Bibi didn't answer for a while. Yes, you have to wonder what corner of hell's reserved for them, he said at last. Some of them might even have found out by now. He seemed very subdued. Naomi hoped he didn't feel guilty for bringing back some painful memories. If anyone had no reason at all to feel guilty, it was Bibi.
Former Covenant battle cruiser Pious Inquisitor. Position unknown. Time unknown.
I think we have to assume it's just us left, Mistress, Bax said.
Chawl squatted on the deck, palms placed flat to feel for vibrations. She was sure that Inquisitor had dropped out of slipspace. The ship had jumped in and out again very quickly, no distance at all in the scheme of the galaxy, just a short step to the side. But space was an overwhelming void to search for something as small as a warship that couldn't transmit a signal. Inquisitor was a cold, black pebble in the darkness. The chances of any other ship stumbling across her were incalculably remote. Their only chance of survival was to take control of the ship. Nobody was coming to save them. Chawl straightened up and walked across to one of the bulkhead sensor terminals to try it again. She prodded the controls a few times, but no display appeared.
Why? Why would the others be dead? Not necessarily dead, Mistress. But we're nearest to the bridge, so perhaps we should assume we're the only ones with a chance of accessing the controls.
There were still search teams in other parts of the ship, trapped between bulkheads by the Hurrigok. That meant some of them were in sealed compartments when the ship jumped and ripped out the umbilical connecting her to Paragon. The only compartment open to space would have been the hangar bay, and the last time she'd seen Ved and Lig, they were wearing their helmets. They didn't have much of an air supply, though.
Rill's party reached engineering, she said. They might be able to get in and activate something. There could have been equipment left in accessible places. We have no way of knowing.
Paragon was another matter. A ship jumping that close to her might have ripped her apart. Anyone in either cargo bay without a suit would probably have been killed anyway. Even if the ship was intact, though, she had no way of tracking them in slipspace. So how far had the Hurrigok moved the ship? Was it picking random locations, or had it taken the ship somewhere specific? All the sensor systems were locked down. Jarl had no way of knowing if the ship was actually in orbit around a planet and had been detected. For once, the human practice of having viewplates everywhere and a bridge on the outer skin of a warship didn't look foolhardy at all. It might have made their ships more vulnerable, but at least they could look outside.
And at least I know we're probably not orbiting Sangelius, waiting for Telcam to reclaim his ship and cut my throat. We'd have been in slipspace longer.
I'm going to see if I can get into one of the conduits.
Bax stood back and looked up the sheer face of the bulkhead, then examined one of the panels in the deck.
What's on the deck below us?
Chol couldn't access the display from here. She racked her brains trying to visualize the deck plan in cross-section again.
It's a machinery space. There have to be some conduits from this deck. Search for those before you break your neck trying to climb to the deckhead openings. We can at least lift a plate and see if there's anything we can use as a tool to force the doors open.
Noit trotted up to join them, brandishing a blade. The two males cut and peeled back the deck covering to expose the metal panels beneath, but they couldn't release the bolts that held it in place. It needed a special tool, or a Hurrigok. Chol paced around looking for deck-level openings in the short passages that led off the main compartment but drew a blank. It was the deckhead conduits or nothing. Chol estimated the cubic air capacity of the section they were trapped in and took out her module to calculate how long the air supply would last for three pairs of Kegyar lungs. It would be used up faster if they were exerting themselves. So did they rest and conserve air, which would prolong the agony if they were drifting unnoticed far from the nearest inhabited world, as she believed, or use it up faster by expending physical effort.
Very well, she said. If this compartment is completely sealed, we have 2 days' air left. By then, we'll have a solution.
Noit looked up at the deckhead again.
Unless those conduits are sealed too, then some air will be filtering in from elsewhere.
Chol had never checked to see if there were airlocks in the Hurrigok Warrens, because they were such a routine part of Covenant warships that she took no special interest in them. There had to be some method of making them airtight, she supposed. There was no point having sections with doors that could be sealed in an emergency, if atmosphere could vent, or if contaminants could seep in via the conduits.
I'm narrower in the shoulders than you, Noit,
Bax said.
I'll try. I only have to make it through to the next exit point because there aren't any more doors between here and the bridge.
You'll never get up there,
Noit said. Bax worked along the panels, digging his claws into edges to see if he could get some purchase. He managed to get halfway up the bulkhead and then jammed his foot into one of the horizontal moldings. Chol watched him shuffle along to the next vertical panel and pick his way up like a fly. But there was no way of reaching the conduit at the angle of the deckhead. Bax made a valiant attempt to swing across, but he couldn't hold his weight. He fell. It wasn't a long drop, not enough to break bones, but he rubbed his shoulder ruefully as he scrambled to his feet.
A pity I didn't remember to bring a rappel line, he said. But then I didn't bring grenades, either.
Chol surveyed the closed doors again.
I think we should go back to the brute force approach.
The control panel was a plain block of metal with no switches to dismantle or short circuit, but that didn't mean it wouldn't yield to an assault, given enough time. What could a Hurrigok do and not do? She still didn't know how far this one would go. And he had to be watching them somehow. Either he was darting around the conduits from section to section, or there were monitoring cameras still operating. She couldn't see them.
How many power packs did you bring?
She asked. Noit patted his belt.
One spare each, mistress. Very well.
Chol stood back and aimed her pistol.
Target the panels. Let's see if we can activate the holographic controls. If the Hurrigok wants to stop us, he'll have to come into this compartment, and then I'll kill the little dungball.
The panel was composite and only fireproof, not melt-proof. She squeezed the trigger. It took several shots to begin to burn a hole through the surface, and the air was already heavy with the smell of melting composite. If she kept this up for a long time, she might make what air they had unbreathable.
Or maybe it'll force the Hurrigok to act. He'll regard that as damage to be repaired. It should at least activate the fire control systems, if he hasn't disabled those as well.
She fired again, three bursts. What was the creature trying to do? Was he saving the ship by immobilizing it? Or was he following orders to sabotage it to the point of destruction to stop it falling into the wrong hands? If she knew for certain, then she could start a fire here and simply wait for the Hurrigok to respond.
Or burn to death. I just don't know.
My turn, mistress,
Bax said. Chol stepped back and let him blast away at the panel. The air was getting thick with the stench, but it was still breathable.
The only ones who can leave the ship are Ved and Lig, if they're still alive. But they've only got spirits, and dropships are no use out here. Wherever here is.
There was still light to this deck. The Hurrigok had kept basic services running, so maybe, no matter how defective he was, he drew the line at killing other sentient beings. Or perhaps he was dependent on the same systems as this section to stay alive. Chol watched as Bax burned through another panel, sending sparks flying. Then a flickering holographic control appeared. Chol reached for it, and the doors creaked. After three loud cracks, they parted to almost shoulder width and stopped.
Have we got anything that'll wedge this open?
Bax said,
in case the Hurrigok manages to close them again. Nothing strong enough to withstand the closing pressure.
Chol motioned him through.
But if we're trapped again, we'll be stuck on the bridge, which is a much better position.
Noit squeezed through the gap, pistol raised, and Chol followed him in. The long ramp up to the command platform stretched ahead of them. But there were no holocharts or other displays active, just the spectrum of lighting that ran through aqua through deep blue to purple. The air felt relatively warm and the gravity was normal. It was too much to hope that the ship's comms might still be working, but Chol tried anyway. She walked up the ramp to the platform and tried voice commands, as well as touching holo panels. Nothing. Inquisitor was still deaf, dumb, and blind.
Bax, how would you achieve this if you were a Hurrigok?
She asked.
What do you mean, mistress?
We can't see what he's shut down because he's disabled all the displays. That might mean that something's functioning, but we can't see it. The central computer must still be running if we have life support and power to the doors.
She looked up and around her, keeping an eye out for sometimes sinks. There were plenty of shadows and alcoves for him to hide in.
See, Hurrigok? Can you see this? You can't stop us. You don't dare kill us. So what are you going to do? Gamble on us running out of air before we've found a way to get the ship running? You'll run out of air, too.
Chol didn't expect a response, but she heard a faint noise in the deckhead, like a distant flag flapping in the breeze. The creature was still moving around in the access conduits. Perhaps he'd come to his senses if she spoke to him firmly enough. He was an organic computer, for pity's sake. He couldn't possibly have opinions.
Vandals! Thieves!
His voice boomed over the ship's address system.
You will not take this ship. It doesn't belong to you. It belongs to the Reclaimer. He respects what the Master's made. I do as he asks, because he does no harm and he means well. He is civilized. Does that thing mean the human?
Noit asked. He was standing by the comms console, groping around where the hollow panel would normally display.
What's a reclaimer? Does he mean salvage?
Suddenly, the bridge was plunged into darkness, so black and enveloping that Chawl almost lost her balance for a moment. Only the faint light from her suit's status indicator provided any orientation at all. In the defended heart of the ship, not even light from a nearby star would penetrate. Chawl froze, trying to remember where the edge of the command platform was. She could see Noit's suit lights. Bax was out of her line of vision.
"Restore the lights, Horagok," she called. "This won't help."
She tried to swallow her anger and growing fear.
"Perhaps we can discuss this. Tell me your grievances."
The bridge was so robbed of light that the smallest glimmer stood out like a beacon. An indicator flared for a moment, right next to Noit. He made a rattling noise of warning.
"I think that's the long-distance comms panel," he said. "The Horagok is sending a signal. I think he might be summoning reinforcements."
Whether it was Telcam or the human, that was bad news. The humans would have described Chawl as a fish in a barrel.
"Well,"
she said, brazening it out,
"reinforcements have to get in. And if they can get in, we can get out. We treat this as an involuntary rescue. Prepare yourselves."
Chapter 13.
I'm old. I have been alone a long time, with no brothers to repair me. So I become prone to error. It is harder to complete the tasks I once did with ease. Why must everyone destroy so much? Let me do my work. That is all I want to do.
Sometimes sinks. Horagok. Exiled by the Jirlhane crew of his last ship for noncompliance. UNSC Port Stanley. Somewhere in the cab sector. Phillips was in the galley with Spencer and Devereaux when Mal went to make himself something to eat. The two blokes were talking in Sangheili, which was both stomach-churning and impressive at the same time. Devereaux watched them, looking fascinated.
"I love it when you talk dirty," Mal said.
Spencer chuckled.
"Just comparing dialects. It's funny how many Kig-Yar words they use, and how many of those the Kig-Yar picked up from us."
"Did you teach them any naughty ones?"
"I tried, but a lot of Kig-Yar can't form a proper F. Comes out as a th or a th sound. Depends on their jaw anatomy. It varies."
"Well, fuck me," Mal said. "Have we got a new swear word? That's a relief. We were wearing out the old ones. Nishum just doesn't do it for me."
He opened the fridge, a massive steel-doored walk-in store with enough supplies to keep a crew of spooks and support staff victualled for a few months without the need for resupply. It was hard to run covert surveillance if the UNSC fleet auxiliary showed up every few weeks with groceries. He rummaged in the racks for an all-day fried breakfast pack and found one, plastered with UNSC warnings and disclaimers about salt, lack of fiber, and lack of key vitamins, signed by a Surgeon Admiral. Mal raised a finger to the label and dogged the door shut before shoving the pack in the heater and setting it to express.
"My stomach hasn't a clue what time it is," he said, stung by the glances.
The timer chirped. He took out a container of sausages, egg, bacon, beans, and mushrooms that glistened invitingly as he peeled back the seal and settled down to tuck in.
"But it's my lunchtime on this watch, anyway."
"You're looking a lot better,"
Spencer said, indicating his nose.
"A lot better than Gareth's arm, probably."
"Who's got Staffan's radio?"
Mal tapped his pocket.
"Me. And Naomi's still chatting with him."
"Did I miss anything, BB?"
"No." BB didn't materialize, but just spoke from the heavens. He didn't sound quite so chipper today. "Adj and Leeks want to play with Spencer's comms equipment, but I think that's asking for trouble."
"They're great little guys."
Spencer stared at an unlit cigarette on the table in front of him, like it was an endurance test.
"Wouldn't let me smoke in the hangar, though. Offered to construct a sealed booth with a filter."
"Cut the distraction bullshit," Devereaux said. "I want to know how Naomi's doing."
BB appeared in person this time and settled on one end of the table. Mal moved up to make room for him.
Not good, BB said.
Not good because of him? Or because she's remembering?
Devereaux asked.
Bit of both, really.
Bad idea to jog her memory.
Mal scooped up a fork full of mushrooms.
Even if that's what she wanted.
So is she really thinking about leaving?
Can't see Orny accepting that. Doesn't matter what the regs say. She's a few billion credits worth of investment and a lot of patents walking around.
Besides, how would she fit back into normal life?
She'd get a job anywhere with private security, Spencer said.
Even without all the hardware she'd have to leave behind. What wouldn't you pay to get a Spartan?
But what would she spend it on?
Phillips asked. Devereaux reached across and took one of Mal's sausages.
You think a nightmarish childhood, a few decades of back-to-back missions, and having all her normal drives channeled into becoming the ultimate killing machine is going to make a good civilian of her, Mal?
I know plenty of blokes and blokesses who won't know what to do with their hands now the war's over either.
He batted her hand away as she reached for a piece of bacon.
But, yeah, she's institutionalized.
It wasn't the kind of word he usually used, because it smacked of dishonesty, the kind of shit that Halsey would come out with to avoid saying more accurate things, like utterly buggered up beyond all recognition. People recovered from all kinds of things, but most of Naomi's youth was gone. Mal decided that would have made him pretty angry if he'd been her. Not that she didn't realize she'd been robbed. It was just that having it rammed down her throat by a heartbroken father meant she couldn't ignore it. Mal was finishing the sausages when Staffan's radio made a squelching sound. He thought he'd sat on it and accidentally powered it up, but it was making noises of its own accord. He fished it out and put it on the table.
Incoming signal, Spencer said. I thought Edvin would have been pinging it like crazy. He must have worked out Staffan's not just lying low by now.
You're sure that it isn't transmitting a location?
Definitely not. The Jelly Boys checked it. So did BB.
Mal put his finger to his lips.
Let's see.
He pressed the receive key. He expected to hear Edvin's voice, worried about his missing father or threatening Earth with Armageddon if they didn't let him go. But instead, it was a weird little nerdy voice that he recognized. There was no preamble.
The ship has been boarded. I have immobilized it in a secure location and trapped the intruders. What must I do now?
It was Sinx, the loony Hurragok. Mal sucked in a breath. Did he risk talking to him? Had Staffan told him that Mal was persona non grata now?
Hello,
Mal said.
Remember me, Sinx? I'm Mal. I came to see the ship with Staffan. I must speak with the Reclaimer. He hasn't called.
That was what the Forerunners called humans. The Hurragok in Onyx had confirmed that. It was time for Mal to make the most of it.
I'm a Reclaimer too, he said. I don't like you. You're not the Reclaimer who respects the work of the Masters. I need to hear his voice.
Mal had never heard a Hurragok get lippy before.
Where are you?
In the ship. That should be obvious.
Yes, but where's the ship?
The Reclaimer knows. Let me hear him. I've sent someone to get him. He'll be a couple of minutes. Who are the intruders? Kig Yar.
Chol Von?
Yes.
Sinx was being cagey. Hurragok were never good at volunteering information, though.
They're damaging the ship. I must speak with the Reclaimer.
BB loomed in front of him, projecting a yellow holographic note with big letters on it.
I can get the originating position.
Mal grabbed a pen from Phillips's shirt pocket and scribbled on the table.
No piggybacking the signal. You'll panic him again.
BB changed the note.
Promise. Just looking.
Okay, Sinx, we're getting the Reclaimer. We're fetching Staffan.
He gestured at BB to get him.
Give us a few minutes.
BB's avatar stayed put, but dimmed and did a flip on its vertical axis every few seconds. He seemed to find the gesture hilarious for some reason. Then the cube reverted to full luminosity again.
On his way,
BB said, then flashed a note.
Got it. Got the location.
It was a big relief. They didn't have to bargain with Staffan now, provided Sinks didn't get spooked and move the ship again. But that made Staffan suddenly surplus to requirements, and Mal knew what Oni did with liabilities it didn't need. Sinks wasn't daft, though. Anything that could keep BB out when he wanted to get in was a force to be reckoned with. Mal heard a little bleating noise. In a human, he'd have taken it as contempt.
You don't have the reclaimer, Sinks said.
Yes, we do.
How long did it take to get him out of the wardroom, for Christ's sakes?
Was he resisting?
Hang on, Sinks.
Enough. I don't trust you. Now I must see him in person before I accept new orders.
The line went dead. BB sighed.
Oh, dear.
He must watch a lot of cop movies. Just as well I had the foresight to nip in and grab the signal data, isn't it? No need to thank me.
Mal wasn't sure if that was a win or not. It definitely wasn't one where Staffan was concerned.
He got up to go and find Osman, but Staffan and Naomi arrived and stood blocking the doorway.
Sinks rang off, Mal said.
Staffan looked tired and a bit red-eyed. Reminiscing about old times must have been pretty painful.
He wants to see you in person before he does anything. He's got the Kig-Yar penned in the ship, and they sound like they're doing a bit of damage trying to take it back.
He makes a pretty good bag man, that Sinks. Staffan nodded approvingly. He didn't seem to be in any hurry, though.
But if he wants to see me, you have to find out where the ship is, and we had a deal.
Mal looked at Naomi. She didn't blink.
Still working that out? Mal asked.
Yes.
Well, we know where the ship is now, so I'm not sure where that leaves your deal.
Staffan just looked a little more weary. I was going through with this in good faith, just in case you bastards had changed in the last 35 years. But you're still all lying shits, aren't you?
I think the Admiral meant it, Mal said.
But what do you expect her to do, now she's got the coordinates?
Shove me out the airlock, probably. Thereby making sure another generation carries on the war. But Sinks won't let you have the ship without seeing me, so maybe you'd better think about how you're going to do that.
He put his hand on Naomi's shoulder.
Take me back to the wardroom, sweetheart. Or the cell.
Just spend a little more time with me.
He turned around and walked off.
Naomi gave Mal a wait gesture and shot off after her father.
Better get to the bridge for a briefing, BB said. I woke the Admiral. By the time she's finished brushing her teeth, I bet she'll have a plan.
Mal didn't like finishing his breakfast anyway. He caught up with Vaz in his cabin. He was having a shave, looking slightly more pissed off than normal. His face seemed a lot better and the swelling had receded to slightly puffy and yellowing bruises, but he was feeling his way around his jaw as if it still hurt.
So we don't need to keep our word, he said, not looking away from the mirror. We have what we want. We cut our way in if need be. And then what?
That's down to Oni, mate. Vaz gave him a long, baleful look.
It's not some committee we've never met. Osman and Perengoski are Oni. They make the policy. This will be unpleasant.
He pulled on his shirt and headed down the corridor with Mal behind him. If Staffan had just been a routine criminal, then it would have been tough, but just. But he wasn't. He was a victim. Mal couldn't square it with himself at all. Osman was waiting on the bridge when they assembled, gulping down a coffee while she stood at the chart table examining a 3D schematic of a CCS-class battlecruiser. There was no sign of Staffan. Naomi slipped onto the bridge a little later than everyone else, and the reality hit Mal. She'd had to go and lock her own father in a cell. Even if there was no intense emotional relationship on her side, then it must still have been pretty painful to have to do that. It couldn't have been a bundle of laughs for her dad, either.
Yeah, I know. I'm feeling sorry for a terrorist. But as far as I know, he hasn't bombed anyone yet. And if he does, maybe it's our bloody fault for making him that way.
Well, people, let's assume Inquisitor still looks like this.
Osman said. She was back to her detached calm, even if it was making her squirm. She probably had a much better idea of what Naomi was thinking, too. Provided the Huragok hasn't moved the ship again, we'll jump in 15 minutes and stand off to observe what's happening, in case the Kig-Yar are there in numbers and decide to act. I'm not worried about them making any dents in us, but I don't want them doing anything that panics the Huragok. Judging by what we've seen, he's not the usual happy little chap who lives to serve. He's cranky, and he only takes orders from Staffan.
He's just taken his original programming to the nth degree, Philip said. He was supposed to take care of Forerunner equipment. He's got a bit bonkers for some reason, and interpreted that as having to defend the ship as well. And he likes Staffan. He's Horatius holding the bridge. The Kig-Yar glassed a Forerunner site, remember? Vaz said, it freaked Sinks out. So Staffan humored him and tested the next firing on open ground. He really seemed to make an impression on the little guy. He's like a one-man dog.
Osman rotated the schematic and enlarged it with a gesture.
So we still need Staffan's cooperation to deal with him.
Mal took heart at that. There was still a deal to be done, then. We don't know how far Sinks will go, or what his orders are, from anyone. He might self-destruct the ship. It makes sense to play nice and negotiate.
Once we winkled the Kig-Yar out of there, Osman said, do we know how many there are?
No, that's another thing we'll have to ask Sinks nicely.
Okay, feel free to stop me at any time if anyone has a better idea. We need to get BB into the systems to take control of the ship. We know he won't get in on a comm signal because Sinks is wise to that. So we have to get access and breach the hull to physically place a fragment into a terminal or whatever else we can find.
Might I suggest, BB said, that I download all the ship's data the moment I get in, just in case it all goes wrong. At least we'll get whatever intel's still in the ship's computer.
Good idea, Osman nodded. Let's make data acquisition and asset denial the minimum objective. And if we get to seize the ship and take her home, all the better. So, once BB has control, we can either isolate the Kig-Yar still on board and clear each compartment the hard way, or just keep them locked down and vent each section. Kig-Yar prisoners are no use to us. Besides, I don't want any survivors going home to Een and making this an official feud with humans. Or Telcam getting to hear about it.
Mev Ut, Phillips said. They'll put a bounty on us individually. Mal and Vaz will have two then. But it could have wider implications for rubbing along with Kig-Yar generally.
Still, no prisoners.
Osman dipped her finger into the aft shuttle bays on each side. Port, then starboard.
If we cut our way in, we might get overtaken by any automated hull sealing systems. The Huragok's probably going to detect it too. So there's no telling how he'll react. We'll need to blow a hatch or two.
Naomi was still studying the schematic. Maybe she was letting work take her mind off the personal stuff, because she seemed her usual self, all business.
I'd still prefer we hit 2 points simultaneously. Even if the Kig-Yar are locked in compartments, if Sinks is going to react, he's going to have to pick one point of entry to respond to, or the other. He can't cover both.
If I vent the ship, Mom, that'll probably kill the Huragok, too, BB said, and he's probably chock-full of lovely data as well. Osman shrugged. Mal thought he knew when she was putting on her bastard face, and when she really was in full unfeeling Oni mode, but right then he couldn't tell.
Normally I'd grab any Huragok we could get our hands on, she said. But we have no idea what's wrong with him. If Edge and Leaks try to fix him, we don't know what problems he might infect them with. I can't risk compromising those two. We have to terminate Sinks. Sorry.
Osman expanded the schematic and zoomed in again.
BB, can he block you? How evenly matched are you?
I can't alter hardware.
Meaning?
BB shrunk himself to a tiny cube and wove through the glowing lines of the ship's blueprint image.
Once I'm in, I doubt he's anywhere near fast enough to stop me.
I can lock him out of the computer network, but if he works out what we're planning, then he might alter the hardware to stop me getting in. We'll have to be quick then, won't we?
Spencer watched the show with his arms folded. Is there any role I can play in this? Mal still didn't know what the agent was privy to,
but he hadn't heard any detail that related to Telcam.
Because I'm not sure what use I am.
Sit this one out, Mike, Osman said. It's an old-style boarding. Man the comms with Phillips. When we're done, we'll drop you off at Ivanov or Anchor 10.
Mal still didn't know where Inquisitor was hiding.
Where exactly are we heading?
BB switched the display to a chart, and it started to make sense. Mal had started to get very familiar with that particular star chart.
Right back to Venezia, BB said. Or at least pretty close. But you only need a few 100,000 kilometers to hide a ship if you don't know where to direct your scans or there's no detectable EM to look for.
Osman checked her watch. There was no discussion about Staffan or the deal at all. Maybe Osman had made up her mind or hadn't a clue how she'd handle it yet. Mal still couldn't tell. He was the ranking NCO here, so it was up to him to ask.
What about Staffan, Mum? He asked. All bets off. And are we going to hand him over to Ivanov or something?
Osman raised her eyes from the watch very slowly.
He still has some help to give us. So if I can reach a point where we all get what we want out of this, while removing an immediate threat to Earth, I'll do it. But I wouldn't want him cooped up in the same facility as Catherine Halsey.
Mal didn't know if that meant she would ship him back to Bravo 6 or shoot him. How did you decide if a man with a grudge on that scale would keep his word? And what the hell was Naomi going to do?
Okay.
Osman looked like she was still checking if they'd be home in time for tea.
Spool us up, BB. Jump when ready.